Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
It's very difficult for the family and everybody. Of course, his mother is very concerned. His brothers are very concerned, you know, and all of his friends around him. He's got such a wide network of people who, you know, who have expressed if they could do anything to help us. And everybody is just, the support has been overwhelming. The more media attention that we have bringing into this particular case and scenario might raise more awareness. He's close to his friends. The people that he's known in his life, he's known all his life. It'd be hard for him to just abandon that. I mean, he would keep contact with somebody, either one of his friends, someone in his family, somebody, but just to vanish. You know, a person I feel would have to be under a lot of duress and very unhappy in the circumstances they were in to just walk away and just vanish like that.
I have to be very, very candid with you. The fact that he's an adult male with no ties to the community is how they phrase it. It's gotten zero to no effort. Everything that's happened, we've done. Which I understand, but it's frustrating as can be.
You know, this was his address for his whole life, 28 years. You probably have heard more, you know, from experience, but to be able to not have anything, you know, if he did want to go off the map and have nothing show up at the house, you know, no mail, no trace, it seems odd to me. Like, you would think you'd have to get some kind of health care. He would have got a job and got some kind of, just some kind of letter or some kind of reference to him still being, but it's pretty much just been letters of where are you?
On May 24th, 2017, 27-year-old Zachary Wilkes left his home in Lompoc, California, to make the familiar drive to his uncle's residence in Las Vegas, Nevada. He planned to spend some time helping his aunt and uncle prepare the family's vacation home for summer guests and also to enjoy seeing his relatives. However, Zachary never made it there, and neither he nor his car have ever been seen again. What happened to Zachary on that 400-mile journey he made so many times before and was looking forward to doing again? I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 182 of The Vanished, Zachary Wilkes' story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. 27-year-old Zachary Wilkes was finding his path in life. While living in his family's home with his brother, going to school, and spending his time with friends and helping out neighbors, he had worked at a local mission and knew his passion in life was giving back to his community. But Zachary wasn't sure how he planned to do that just yet. While researching this story, we spoke to his mother, Elizabeth, who shared what Zachary's kind spirit is like and what she remembers of Zachary as a child.
Zachary growing up, Zachary was my happy child. He's the middle boy of three. He, you know, was close enough to his brothers. Good kid growing up. Really close. He has friends as he's had since elementary school, and they're still would be considered best buds. And that's the person, you know, you would call Zachary when you needed something, when you needed a friend or when you needed a ride or when you needed a cigarette. That is him. He was that way with family, which is kind of what put him in the situation that he was in. Zachary, after high school, he went to junior college. He worked. He socialized. He was, along with my youngest son, a primary caregiver to their 99-year-old grandfather who lived with in their house with us. He was capable. He just needed a ride now and then or just to be reminded to turn the stove off. So he did that when he was not at school. He worked on and off. He'd been off for a while. He had hurt his finger in a door. It needed to be reset, and it had to be opened up and got infected. And so he was just regaining the use of his right hand. He was a good kid. He was he's a man. He was everybody's help.
We were also able to talk to Zachary's dad, David, and he shared many of the same sentiments about Zachary's kind and gentle spirit, as well as his passion for serving others.
You know, as a child growing up, he was a very good child, very mild-mannered. He wasn't, I would say, a difficult child to try to raise. Of course, there's always the, with growing pains, you know, through adolescence, you know, there's always they're trying to find themselves and who they are. Of course, his mother and I always tried to give him the best advice and guidance going through that period. But, you know, never any incidents with law enforcement or with school officials, you know, or anything like that. He was pretty a good child, fairly good grades in school. You know, he maintained. He had a little difficulty adjusting to the middle school, the high school times, put him in charter schools. But as far as our relationships, one with another, it was always good. We found a hobby that we shared together was golfing, and we would golf, you know, and spend time alone bonding, you know, a father-son type of bonding thing. So I feel always an open relationship, talking back and forth. It was pretty easy. I didn't feel like there was anything he was hiding or trying to, you know, anything like that. It was always a fairly open relationship with us. After high school, we encouraged him to go to school, to continue on with education, but he went to work down in Santa Barbara. He worked at the Old Mission Santa Barbara for probably 2 years. And that was a work experience for him, which was good, a cashier's experience and other types of things. He also was involved in doing home maintenance. Of course, one of the things that I showed him how to do was handyman work, you know, working with his hands, working carpentry work, masonry work, just all kinds of things. And he kind of took a liking to that and would help neighbors and family members, you know, if they needed help remodeling a kitchen or a bathroom or something like that. He was always there doing his best to help somebody with that. So those are the two types of things he was doing. After high school, I did decide to go ahead and pursue a degree in business. And he started with that, and he graduated from a local junior college with that degree. He more got fulfillment with helping somebody who needed help. I think that was the intrinsic for him. He really liked to help people, especially those who couldn't so much help themselves. He would help neighbors out, for example, if someone, you know, had a project to do, but they couldn't afford to do it or something like that. You know, he would use his own resources and talents to help neighbors out and friends and anybody he could, really.
Zachary's parents, Elizabeth and David, had moved to the Washington, D.C. metro area. So Zachary and his brother Andrew remained in the family home in Lompoc, California, so that they could attend college. We also spoke to Andrew and asked him what his relationship with his brother was like.
He was a very good brother. We had a very good household, good family.
And we were very close, me and him, up to, we were now in our mid-20s, and we were still close. We both lived in Lompoc, California. We were both born and raised in the same house, and we lived, you know, our entire childhood here, and we had a good childhood. We went on a lot of vacations. We were always together as a family, and we honestly, we had a very good childhood. After high school, we didn't go to college right away, but we both did go to college, you know, after a few years. We were both went to charter school, so we did not go to traditional high school. But after high school, we did various work. Then eventually, we both went to community college. He was studying business, and so was I. We both kind of worked together on that. He did work at the Santa Barbara Mission for after high school for several years. And then after that, he did various kind of jobs, maintenance and such. The Santa Barbara Mission is an old Spanish mission that he worked at for 2 to 3 years, where he worked after high school. And both in college and I just got accepted into a university type deal. And he was kind of struggling to just finish community college. And that kind of, I think, affected him. You know, he was a little bit disappointed in himself to say that, you know, he wasn't where he wanted to be in life yet. He probably, you know, want to be somewhere where he could do something maybe for the gay community, maybe.
We asked Andrew what he knew about Zachary's planned trip to Las Vegas and what happened the day that Zachary left on the road trip.
What he did is he planned a trip out to Las Vegas, and he told everyone he was going to Las Vegas, and he told everyone his plans, and it was very clear, you know, what he was going to do. And then he eventually, you know, packed up all his stuff, which we didn't exactly find suspicious at the time. But looking back now, it did. So he left to Las Vegas, and he was pretty normal. He, up to him leaving, it was, you know, somewhat uncharacteristic of him, but at the time it didn't seem uncharacteristic. He was real adamant about not calling the relative that he was going to see. He was going to see my uncle. And I kept telling him that he needed to call him to tell him when he was going to get there, because it kept getting later and later in the day. And to Las Vegas is about a 7-hour drive. And by the time he was leaving would have been about, he was getting there about 4 a.m. And he refused to call our uncle, which seemed very unlike him, because he knows our uncle will worry. He didn't call, and then he left. We didn't hear from him. We thought he would get there, even though we thought he would get there very late. We still thought he would get there. And then, you know, after half a day, we thought, okay, maybe he's just taking his time.
Zachary's dad shared a bit about what Zachary planned to do when he got to Las Vegas to visit his aunt and uncle.
And then his uncle had a project to do on Lake Powell. He owns a houseboat up there, and every year he goes up and gets it ready to launch for the summer season. It's a timeshare type of thing. And there's always work to do. And typically his younger brother, Andrew, would go up there, and Philip, his older brother, would go up there. They kind of take turns. So it was his two brothers were busy at that time. They couldn't get away because of school and work and their own personal work and things like that. And Zachary was available. So Zachary had scheduled with his uncle to go up there and help this year to ready that project for the summer. He packed up like he was going to my brother's house, his uncle's house, and, started off kind of late, but we thought, okay, that's not that unusual. He knows the route really well.
Zachary's brother Andrew had expected to hear from him or their aunt and uncle that he'd made it to Las Vegas, but he never got that call. As I mentioned earlier, their parents were 2,000 miles away in the Washington, D.C. area. So when we spoke to Elizabeth, we asked her to tell us what she remembers from the day Zachary disappeared.
He was on his way to Las Vegas to meet up with his aunt and uncle, and then they were going to go to Lake Powell and work on a houseboat. He was kind of spending the day closing up, finishing his, you know, just the stuff that he had at home to do. And he didn't leave really early. He left later at night. But as far as everybody knew, you know, he left under good terms. He left in a good situation. He left in a good frame of mind. He wasn't dreading this. He wasn't not wanting to go. He was good. He didn't go the way everybody thought he was going to go travel, but that wasn't unusual. The way he went is the way we went as a family all the time. He knew that he was going to be getting there early, so he had told his brother that when I get to Las Vegas, I'm going to go and, you know, just kill some time at a casino rather than show up at Uncle Bob's house at 5 in the morning, and that wouldn't have been unusual. Even when we didn't hear from him on that Thursday, we were okay. You know, we weren't that panicked because it was like, oh, you know, he probably pulled in. He's sitting in the car sleeping somewhere. He'll sleep it off and show up. You know, nobody saw him by Friday.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. After Zachary's parents and brother realized that something was wrong, and this was more than just a road trip delay, his mom and dad immediately flew back to Lompoc from their home in Maryland, and the search for Zachary began. Elizabeth works in the wireless communications industry and was able to get some help in trying to ping Zachary's phone. Elizabeth shared some of the other things they did in the search for their son.
By Friday, after many calls and things like that, then we had his younger brother who lived with him in Lompoc. We actually live in Maryland, my husband and I, and he lived back in Lompoc, California, which is where our family home is. And so he reported him missing, and as a 27-year-old, there's just not a lot they do. We live in a small town, and the police aren't super helpful with a missing adult because they just assume he's on a walkabout. And so we got involved. We hired a gentleman who flies a drone and who does these kind of missing persons and searches. And we had him go one route, and then we were able to get AT&T to tell us which cell tower that his last phone had pinged off of. And so then we changed routes and searched the other route. We spent several days doing that. We spent several days as a family, extended family, family friends, searching the route to no avail. Drove to Vegas several times, stopped at every substation along the way, and there was nothing. I work for a union that represents people that work for AT&T, and we were able to contact an AT&T vice president. And with a subpoena that the Lompoc police had gotten, we were able to get a little bit more information, and we were able to find that his cell phone had pinged in the same place for 5 hours. So that led us to believe that he had pulled over and had slept. But it was still in the ping zone. And the road that he went down has got a lot of treacherous areas. But the area that the zone that he was in was not. It was a lot of orchards and grapes and things like that. So if the car had gone off the road, you could have clearly seen it from the road. And again, we were there about 4 days after he disappeared and had spent several weeks there searching. When he left, he left with everything well. He was going to go spend some time on the houseboat. And after the houseboat, then he was going to come and spend some time with us here in D.C. So he had the option that if he wanted to come live with us, that was fine. So he pretty much closed up his room. He boxed up his stuff, put it in the rafters. And so a lot of people took that as that he was going to leave. You know, he was leaving. He was, but it was not an unknown trip to me. He had shared this with his dad. He had shared this with me, that he was going to be leaving California and coming here to the D.C. Maryland area. So a lot of his friends think that he went on a walkabout, but that's just not in his DNA. I mean, there was no reason for him to. There was no reason for him to go that day. You know, he lived 2,000 miles away from us. He could come and go as he pleased. He lived on his own before. We talked, we texted, we were close, but I wasn't in his business. He lived his life. Although a lot of people feel it's a walkabout, it just doesn't make sense intuitively. But at this point, nothing makes sense. You know, what kind of 27-year-old man leaves money in his bank account, doesn't max out his credit cards, had a new phone, the phone just didn't die. Your title being vanished is quite apropos for Zachary. I mean, he literally has vanished. He has not used an ATM, not used a credit card, not done anything. We have exhausted every lead, every car that looks vaguely familiar. We have YouTube videos out there. We have a website. We've spent tens of thousands of dollars looking for him to nothing. I mean, we are unable to figure anything else out. In the little community where the cell phone pinged, they've been extremely kind and extremely, I mean, you still go there and they keep posters up and they keep looking, but there's been nothing.
Zachary's father told us what he remembers from the initial days of the search for Zachary that spanned such an immense area, 400 miles of rough terrain in California.
He didn't show up. We gave a little length of time, but not very much. Right after his disappearance, we started searching the roadways, the possible routes that he would have taken to reach his destination, which first destination is Las Vegas. We had Highway 1 from Lompoc to Santa Barbara aerial surveilled with a private contractor who professionally uses drone cameras. So we camered the road all the way. And there's a lot of places you can get off the highway there. A car could disappear in a ravine, such as that. The next step we took was the next possible route would be from Lompoc to Nukuyama to Victorville. And we also had that person scan that whole area in there. We had a suspicion that he had last phone contact in Nukuyama. So we searched the Los Padres National Forest around the Kuyama area, all the back roads with, you know, a caravan of people and aerial drones. So we searched the whole that whole area between New Cuyama, Santa Barbara, and Ventura, all those back roads. Questioned people we saw along the way. We also made contact with all of the local fire department, National Park Services in that area, and we also contacted local sheriff substations from Lompoc all the way to Victorville, and then on up into Las Vegas. So we notified law enforcement, personally walked into their substations, talked to the sergeant there at their in those substations, gave them flyers, let them know what we were doing and who we were looking for. So we made personal contact with law enforcement all along the way. We also notified Lompoc Police Department and filed missing person reports with them and tried to get as much, cast a very wide net. Also, we interviewed with one of the local television stations in the area that did a special broadcast for a search for that. I understand that the police's resources are limited. You know, they don't have an unlimited resource to go out and try to find everything. Based on what information that we could give them about his disappearance, I think they knew as much as we did. They may have drove down the road and looked for tire tracks off the side, but they didn't really go out and help us a lot. They were not too involved.
Elizabeth mentioned that Zachary was feeling a bit restless with the decisions he had to make about what he wanted to do with his life and where he wanted to end up. But what she doesn't understand is why he would pick the day that he planned to go see his aunt and uncle to make a sudden life change and disappear to start a new life.
He's just kind of had it with life, and as he knows it, and wants to take some time and discover himself. And, you know, it's something that we talked about with him growing up. But again, there was just really no reason for him to feel like he needed to get away that day. He could have gone away any day. He could have just been on his own any day. His dad had left home rather young in life and had hitchhiked across country to his brother's house. And that was a known family story. And, you know, it was a cool thing to do in the 60s. But when we had talked about it, when we had always talked about doing it, it was like, well, yeah, he went 100 miles and then he called his dad and he had a destination. So when we had talked about it, it had been talked about in that sense. Sure, you do it, but just, you know, don't lose yourself and, you know, let us know you're okay. So that is in his MO. His MO, even at 27, when he wasn't going to come home, he'd shoot me a text, staying out tonight, which is how he was raised and how we raised all of our boys.
Elizabeth told us about the area where Zachary's phone last pinged.
So the tower is McPherson Peak Tower. It's in New Cuyama, which is a town that borders the Santa Barbara County and Ventura County border. It is up in a hill, and what it does is it has a diameter ping of about 13 miles, I believe is what it is. And although the tower's way up high in the hills, you literally can't get there any way. There's no road access to it. So what we did is we took the circumference of the circle and began the search. You know, this is when you come into this tower's, that's how cell phones go. They go from tower to tower. So we can tell from a map where the tower pings in and to when it pings out and when it goes to the next tower. There are some farm roads, which we looked at extensively. There are some county roads, which we looked at. The gentleman that drove the drone, he actually has some ATVs, and he went out with the National Park Service, and the National Park Service knew of some areas that might be suspect, might be, you know, areas of interest, but were not able to find anything. We spoke with two different game wardens in the two different counties, and they also they're on ATVs and horses. If for any reason he would have driven off the main road, which, mind you, is a two-lane road, it's a fairly well-traveled road for a two-lane road, but it's not by any means a highway, a multi-lane freeway. So the terrain up towards the mountains is, of course, mountainy, but he was driving a 1994 Honda Civic that was low to the ground. I mean, he would have gotten stuck on the first bump. There was no way that he could have driven that car anywhere vaguely off the main road.
Andrew told us about his frustrations with the lack of law enforcement involvement and interest in the beginning of the search.
It was difficult because there was all we had was about one information about where he, you know, the route he might have took or he did take. But other than that, we didn't have any people who saw him or any kind of clues or any leads. So it was kind of a blind search. We got more input from the news, our local news, than we ever did. The police didn't do much searching. There wasn't much information to be forthcoming about, but they were honest, but they didn't really seem active in their search.
As Elizabeth mentioned earlier, Zachary was driving a 1994 black Honda Civic when he disappeared. That car has never been found, nor has Zachary's cell phone. While speaking with Zachary's dad, we asked if the car has ever been spotted, or if there's been any leads on it. This is what he shared.
The car is registered to me. So the car is registered in my name. I keep the insurance paid on it. I keep the registration up on it. So it's an active automobile. So if anything would happen, you know, if it would show up somewhere, well, it would automatically, you know, I'd get some notification of that because I'm the owner of the vehicle.
Elizabeth also discussed having Zachary's phone pinged, and that was successful, with the last known ping being on Zachary's planned route along Highway 166. However, neither the car nor the phone were located along that highway. And although the wireless carrier was able to determine that Zachary's phone had received a text message just after 12 a.m. on May 25th, 2017, this would have been just after midnight on the day that he left. But by 1 a.m., the phone had died or been powered down. Zachary's dad shared more about the cell phone as well.
The phone is registered to me as well, me and Elizabeth, his mom. So we have the phone bill. So if his phone is used, we would see on the phone bill if it was ever used. Since the time of his disappearance, it has not been used. And when we was on the road looking, you know, around that Kuyama area and stuff, we were actually walking the roads looking for someone would have run over his phone or if he would have smashed his phone or something, but we didn't find any evidence of a cell phone.
Elizabeth mentioned earlier that Zachary had injured his finger after accidentally slamming it in a door. That injury failed to heal properly. Zachary had to be hospitalized during this time. And that's when he learned that he was HIV positive. He immediately began taking a regimen of medication after the diagnosis. But his family is concerned that he's out there somewhere unable to access the benefits that provide him with these life-sustaining medications. Here's Elizabeth sharing more about how Zachary learned of his HIV diagnosis.
Zachary was HIV positive. Actually, we didn't know. We didn't have an affirmative diagnosis until the finger. But as of the last test that we had, the medication was doing what it needed to do. So he was actually not testing positive anymore. But again, that's just a false. It's only better because of the medication.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Since Zachary needs these medications to maintain a healthy life, and also because we wanted to know more about how HIV treatment has evolved over the last several decades, we spoke with an expert. We were fortunate enough to interview Greg Millett, Vice President and Director of Public Policy for AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research. We asked Greg to introduce himself and explain what HIV is.
My name is Greg Millett. I am the Director of Public Policy at AMFAR. That's the Foundation for AIDS Research. My office is responsible for policy work around domestic and global HIV. And in a previous life, I was a scientist at CDC for 10 years and also helped develop the previous administration's national HIV/AIDS strategy for the president. HIV is the virus that causes AIDS, human immunodeficiency virus. AIDS is a condition, a set of conditions that an individual has, a syndrome that is caused by HIV as a person ages with HIV without treatment. So you have opportunistic infections that are associated with it, some that can cause blindness, some that can cause all sorts of oral diseases. In the older days, before any type of medication for opportunistic infections, they would also cause these cancerous lesions called sarcoma. It's a whole suite of infections that's defined by having HIV over a period of time without any treatment. There are fewer and fewer people who actually have AIDS in the United States. As it stands right now, we're doing a really wonderful job of diagnosing people earlier in their infections as compared to later in their infections when they would have AIDS. So right now we're diagnosing people primarily when they are infected with HIV before they progress to AIDS. And that's a good thing, because if you have HIV before progressing to AIDS, your treatment outcomes are better once you're placed on treatment. Right now, medical science has just been incredible. It's been revolutionary, actually, over the past 30 years of the epidemic. So in the 80s and the 90s, people were actually dying from AIDS. Now, its mortality rates have really plummeted. People living with HIV, once they're diagnosed, as soon as they start taking treatments, can live long, happy, productive lives, nearly as long as if they weren't infected with HIV. And the other side benefit of the treatment is that it renders people non-infectious. So people who are living with HIV, who are taking their medications daily, are far less likely to transmit HIV as much as 99% to almost non-existent likely to transmit HIV than if they were not on those medications. So we really are in a completely different era of dealing with HIV in the United States that thankfully is a very good sign.
Many of us remember when AIDS and HIV were considered a crisis or epidemic in the United States. We asked Greg to describe what the AIDS epidemic was and how things have changed since then.
30 years ago, we were in the middle of a crisis, not only in the United States, but internationally. It was a new virus that no one had really seen before. It was infecting a multiplicity of communities. I think back in the 80s, the thing that we often heard were the four H's: hemophiliacs, Haitians, homosexuals, and heroin addicts who were infected with HIV. And at the time, people didn't know exactly what was taking place. They just knew large swaths of communities, particularly in urban areas, were being decimated by the disease. First we saw in San Francisco, and then where I lived in New York City, where you can walk down the street, quite frankly, and see somebody who was emaciated, see somebody who had lesions on their skin, having friends who passed away from the disease. The amount of deaths that took place in many of these places were just staggering, where you had literally a whole generation of individuals who passed away, not only in the United States, but also around the world, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. So it was a very difficult time for many of us who lost quite a few friends, whole friendship networks and others, with people who were grappling with the disease. Thankfully, that all changed. Medical science completely changed what took place there. And now many people are living happily with HIV, and many people don't even realize that they're HIV positive because they don't have those manifestations that we saw 20 and 30 years ago of people who are wasting, people who had visible signs of illness. People living with HIV today who are on their medications look like me or you or anybody else, and no one would ever know that they're HIV positive until they told you. There were a lot of misconceptions in terms of food preparation, that, you know, people didn't want someone who was living with HIV to handle their food. People were afraid as well of sharing a toilet seat with someone who had HIV for fear of contagion. People were afraid of being in pools with somebody who was HIV positive. Or there was even some people who were wondering whether or not a mosquito, if it bit somebody who was HIV positive and then went ahead and bit somebody else who was HIV negative, whether or not that could be an efficient route to transmit HIV. All of these things were myths. None of them were true. But unfortunately, they seem to persist in the United States. There was a really wonderful survey that Kaiser Family Foundation pulled together back in, I guess it was 1987, where they asked whether or not you can get HIV through a mosquito, through a toilet seat, or through sharing a drink with somebody who is HIV positive, or being in a pool with somebody who is HIV positive. And about 30% of Americans believe that you could. Unfortunately, that number really hadn't changed by the time that we got to 2007, where you still had stubbornly a large number of Americans who really believed that you could get HIV through any one of those means. So even though we've made advances in terms of medication and in terms of treating HIV, just huge leaps and bounds in terms of these advances, we haven't made as many advances yet in reducing HIV/AIDS stigma. Medical science in and of itself has been a game changer in reducing stigma. So the fact that somebody who is HIV positive can take a pill every day and be rendered non-infectious is huge news, and in some ways reduces stigma around people living with HIV. The other medical breakthrough, newer medical breakthrough within the last 10 years, where people who are not HIV positive can take a pill every day. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis. And it actually prevents them from getting HIV if they come into contact with HIV. So there are people who are HIV negative who have partners who are HIV positive. Even if their partners are not virally suppressed or not on medication, if the HIV negative person is taking this pill every day, it prevents them from getting HIV. That has also been revolutionary in reducing HIV/AIDS stigma. We've seen in Europe, we've seen here in the United States, in those communities where pre-exposure prophylaxis has really taken off. It's primarily among gay and bisexual men, that these old prejudices and these lines that separated men who are positive and men who are negative are really dissolving. And people now are willing to date across serostatus because we have these medical innovations that really render any type of transmission nearly impossible. So those things have been helpful in terms of HIV/AIDS stigma. I think the other things that have been helpful as well have just been knowing somebody who's HIV positive. You have more and more people who are coming out about their serostatus. They're coming out to their families, they're coming out to friends, they're coming out to coworkers about their serostatus. And just like, you know, other conditions where people start to talk about it, some of the stigma dissipates. You have to remember back in the 70s and 60s, breast cancer was considered something that, you know, many women were afraid to talk about. There was so much stigma that was associated with it. As many more women started talking honestly about their diagnoses and really forming support groups, et cetera, that stigma really gradually reduced. You see to a certain degree some of that also happening with HIV. When you see that HIV/AIDS stigma is still prevalent in the United States, I mean, consider what happened when Charlie Sheen came out about his HIV status just 2 years ago. You know, we are well advanced into the epidemic. People know that there are drugs that are available that render people non-infectious. But still, a lot of the news around Charlie Sheen's disclosure was how many women did he transmit HIV to? You know, all these women who were alarmed that they had slept with him, even though he was non-infectious. A lot of that discourse is the same discourse that we heard with Rock Hudson and Linda Evans, you know, back in, good gosh, 1985, 1984 with Dynasty, when they kissed on set. And people subsequently found out that Rock Hudson was HIV positive. We really haven't changed in that shock value and fear of HIV transmission, even though people who are HIV positive and on medication are just not infectious.
Zachary's family has wondered if he could have just decided to walk away and start a new life. But we know he needs his medications. What I was wondering is if Zachary could be obtaining those medications while staying under the radar.
These drugs can be expensive. You know, when you're taking antiretroviral medication, it's about, I'd say, $20,000 or so per year. In terms of lifetime costs for treatment, CDC and others estimated it's about $367,000 for lifetime treatment. So these are definitely expensive drugs, which is why you see such a premium being placed on prevention. I think it'd be pretty unlikely that person would be receiving medications without it being tied to their identity. He was probably getting something, as you'd mentioned, through Medi-Cal. He was probably in the Ryan White program in the United States, where, you know, people who are indigent are more likely to be on Ryan White. It provides excellent services for people living with HIV in the United States. They have an incredible record of viral suppression among people on the Ryan White program. But people need to know your identity. I'd say perhaps because of HIPAA laws and other issues that his identity wasn't necessarily disclosed. But people definitely need to know who you are if you're receiving medications anywhere in the U.S. In most cases, people living with HIV who are on private insurance or even on public insurance, they are certainly known to their providers. Their names and others are known to their providers. Those lists and those names, though, are guarded religiously. In fact, you know, providers are prosecuted if the names are breached somehow. In fact, I think there was a breach in the South of individuals living with HIV. Their provider somehow had a virus that was on their computer in a clinic, and it somehow publicly released the names of people living with HIV who are from that clinic, and those providers were prosecuted. So people know who these individuals are if you're a provider, but we have very strict confidentiality laws where that information is not necessarily shared with anyone.
Some of the cases that I've covered seem to have such a clear outcome. But Zachary's story isn't one of them. There's no evidence that his disappearance wasn't voluntary, and also no evidence that it was. His family doesn't know what to think. We asked his mom, Elizabeth, what her take is on his disappearance.
I can go everywhere every day. I honestly don't know, because nothing makes sense. And I think that's the hardest part for this, for me specifically, is it's like, I just need an answer, and there's nothing. There's no reason that I can think of that anybody would want to hurt him. But we live in a crazy world, so who knows? I want to think he's on a walkabout, because I want to think that, you know, he'll have his moment, and he'll be better, and he'll come back, and he'll be fine. But then I think about the pain he must be in, or his need to get away. And that's even a harder thing for me to deal with as his mom. So I really don't have an answer, which is what tears us apart as a family. I mean, it's just devastating to not have really any clue, or to know that there are so many people that this is happening to. It's just insane. It's just horrible. His older brother's mad. He thinks he's on a walkabout, and he's angry because he's being protective of me, of what he's putting me through. His younger brother is just willing to do anything. It's like, okay, I need you to go give a swab, a DNA swab. I need you to go here. I need you to do this. And he's just on it constantly, and watching him just break down, because he was the one that was supposed to go to the lake, and he didn't. His brother went for him. And so I think he feels a little bad. His father, he's an extremely optimistic person. He really feels that Zachary's on a walkabout, and that once he finds himself and figures it out, he'll be back.
Zachary's brother Andrew shared some of his thoughts on what may have happened to Zachary that day and where he may be now.
Well, Zachary had a little bit of a unique personality, and it didn't quite cohere to, we live in kind of a smaller town, and it didn't quite cohere. He kind of wanted to live in a big city. I think he kind of wanted to be out on the town, and it kind of wasn't, his personality wasn't quite what was going on here. So I think he kind of wanted to get away from this kind of small town. I was under the impression that no one was caring for him or loving for him, and that he wouldn't really be missed, I think was his impression. And so I think he thought he could do this with, and no one would really care, but obviously, you know, so many people do.
San Francisco is not far. It's about, it's very close. And he's been there several times. In my honest gut opinion is, when he went out to where he was driving, you know, you drive out to the 5 highway in California, and you can either go north to San Francisco or south to Los Angeles. Those are probably two good guesses of where he probably is. I think he had bigger aspirations outside of it. You know, it's a fairly, you know, bedroom type community. It's very quiet.
Like Andrew, Zachary's dad believes that maybe he did choose to start a new life. But he also recognizes that something more sinister could have happened on the day that he left for his aunt and uncle's house. This is what he believes happened to Zachary.
I can only speculate what the circumstances or the scenarios that could have happened. Of course, there could have been foul play involved. If Zachary, somewhere on the road there, ran into a circumstance where ran into foul play, that's always an option. I mean, that happens everywhere we go. I mean, we live in this kind of world. Zachary could have made a decision to make a change in lifestyle, just disappear and go off and do his own life somewhere else without his family, without his friends. Really, the only two things that I could think of that could be the two possible scenarios. Eventually, he wanted to be independent and run his own business. I think he worked with, you know, there at the mission was a good experience for him. I don't think he felt like he really wanted to just be in the 9-to-5 drudgery every day, because he liked so much to go out and help other people. He liked his handyman work, his skills and his trades that he acquired. I just think Zachary just wanted to be a person that could be a benefit to the community and to the people around him. Of course, he's a young man, and he hadn't really figured out what his career path would be. But I could see him, that would be the place he would be the happiest, is helping people around him.
So what happened to Zachary Wilkes on May 24th, 2017? Did he take the route he had driven so many times before? Was he met with foul play while driving? Could he have stopped to help a stranded motorist and ran into trouble? Is there a chance he decided to leave and start a new life entirely? Could he have gotten into an accident and his car has never been recovered? At the time of his disappearance, Zachary Taylor Wilkes was 27 years old. He's approximately 5'10" tall and weighs about 180 pounds. He has brown hair and hazel eyes. He has a rose tattoo on his right leg. Zachary is in need of life-sustaining medication and may be in need of medical treatment. If you have any information about the disappearance of Zachary Wilkes, please call the Lompoc Police Department at 805-736-2341. You can follow Zachary's story on social media at Find Zachary Wilkes.
I mean, the only place that he would go would be, that I know of, that he knew of, would be to go to Cabo, which is where his uncle lives. And that was the uncle he was going to see, so it makes zero sense that he would, I mean, he's pretty much unfamiliar with anything else. You try to think of everything you know to think about, but then lots of things you don't think about. All of his friends were in our town. He had a friend here and there, the couple of friends that I knew that were out of the area. I mean, we were on them day one. We've been, you know, communicating since that day to try to, you know, have you heard from him? Have you seen him? You know, what can you do? What can we do? Like I said, the people that I know just aren't, they haven't seen him. And I just don't think they would, they have no reason to lie about it. I mean, there's just nothing to gain.
Even though time goes by, you know, there's still things that are unanswered. For example, he has a car is missing. Okay, you would think you would find an automobile somewhere. Even though, whatever the situation, you would find an automobile. But I think we just need to heighten the awareness, and that's what I feel. I don't want this to just die down and go away because it's unresolved. I think that would be my plea to you and what you're doing in your podcast, is to help us keep the awareness up, and something will, at some point, something will come to light, and we'll find out what happened to Zachary.
That brings us to the end of episode 182. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for the show. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on The Vanished, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you want to join in on the discussion, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at TheVanishedPod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from New York. Thanks for listening.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.